Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, tomorrow is our last full day of practice. Everybody here is very sincere. It's very nice to see. Everybody is asking good questions. Really been enjoying the question and answer sessions. People are trying to fathom the Four Noble Truths, trying to figure it out, how it works, how it's applied, how to practice. Which is good. The Buddha said an effort should be made to fathom these Four Noble Truths, to figure out these Four Noble Truths. And we're all seeking, we're all here swimming in the Dhamma practice for 10 days, complete immersion. And there's the monastic form, 227 precepts for the bhikkhus, 10 for novices, 8 precepts for anagarikas and for the lay people on this retreat. But it's good to see that it's just a form. There's just these different forms. There may well be lay people holding 5 or 8 precepts who have more integrity and more internal virtue than some bhikkhus. It's not fixed. Nothing is fixed here. The virtue is internal. And anyone who's realized stream entry, the fruits of stream entry, that's the internal ordination. So even if you're a lay person, the heart is noble. One is termed a noble one once one has reached that point. One is part of the Arya Sangha. But the monk's form is, it's a reminder, the sign of the samana, the robe that we wrap around our body, also known as the banner of the arahants. It's the way the Buddha chose to dress, live simply. The robe, it's sewn in the rice paddy field pattern, in the story of the Buddha with Ananda. It's a lovely setting. The picture that's painted in the suttas is the sun is setting, the Buddha's going for a walk with Ananda. They're up on a bluff, and there's a cliff, and it's overlooking the rice paddy fields of Magadha. And the Buddha says, "You know, Ananda, make me a robe like those paddy fields in that paddy field pattern." And we have that in every tradition of Buddhism to this day. You know, Chinese Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, Thai, Burmese, Sri Lankan, even Tibetan Buddhism. All the robes have that paddy field pattern. But maybe it's not remembered where that pattern came from, but that's a link between all the Buddhist traditions. And why that pattern? That's because we're supported by rice from the lay people, and it's a reflection of the work that goes in to supporting us in the cultivation of gratitude. And it's also a reflection of what our body, earth element, built up out of rice, built up out of food. So the robe we wear, it's showing what we are and where we come from. So it's good to remember why we're here, and good to ask oneself, why do we practice? And why are we here at this retreat? And why do we practice? Why do we keep practicing? What gave rise to our desire to practice in the first place? This is a quality we call saddha, which is translated as faith, also means courage. Saddha. What gave rise to saddha in the first place? Like for myself, I remember reading A Still Forest Pool, reading Longpa Cha, his teachings, and saddha arising, you know, based on just these words in the book. It can be like a warm feeling or a strong conviction that these words are true. This is something I want to follow. I can't ignore this. And also the courage aspect comes into play with the decision, I'm going to practice. I can't ignore these teachings, and I'm going to do what I can to practice and realize these teachings and reform my life to be in line with these teachings. And we're all in this together. Monks, lay people, everybody is in this together. We all help each other out. I remember some of the most important meditation instruction I received when I was in Anagarika was actually from Jayanta there in the front. Not to clench my teeth when I meditate. So even though I had saddha, maybe it was a bit strong, and I had a view that it was to be done to clench one's teeth and try as hard as possible to crush the mind into submission. So sincere, but a little bit over-enthusiastic. Just a little. So everything is teaching us. Everyone is teaching us. And it takes a long time to learn a skill. The skill of meditation is just like anything else, or the skill of keeping precepts. Keeping precepts is a skill as well. Some questions around how to work with speech, how to keep the precept against wrong speech. That's telling lies, divisive speech, harsh speech, or idle chatter, gossip. You know, how do we avoid these things? But they're training guidelines. If we were already pure in our conduct, we wouldn't need them. But because we have things we can work on, ways we can reform ourselves, we need these training precepts to teach us. They're not commandments. The earth's not going to open up and swallow us into hell if we gossip or break some of the precepts, but they're training guidelines. They point out what's happening in the mind, what's the intention, and then we pick ourselves up. In the Sangha, we confess if we've transgressed a precept, confess it with another monk, and then try not to do it again in the future. So to try our best. But these are all skills, and no skill can be mastered quickly. One might be able to get good at something, but to master a skill or a craft takes time, and it's easy to I can think of myself I think something changed when I turned 30 in that I got more patient with any skill, meditation included, but with anything that I took on. And now I can look back at the pre-30 monks in the monastery and say, yeah, well, they'll be patient later on, I think. Because you see people, you know, take something on and try to learn something, like something simple like using a tool or trying to make bowl stands, and then, which is actually a very difficult craft. It's the most difficult monk craft that we can take on. And just giving up, you know, after 2 weeks, 3 weeks of trying, okay, it's not working, I'm going to give up. No, I'm just not going to do it. So that's what it can be like with meditation. You know, we might learn how to get peaceful to a certain point, and then we run up against a wall. And that wall is there for a long time, could be months, even years. We run up against a wall and we aren't able to deepen our practice any more than that, it seems. But that's the wall that we have to get over in order to get to the next level of skill. Or it's like sharpening. Like, this is something which in the past year I've been learning how to do, sharpening things. And at first, you read the books and learn how to sharpen something. And there's the first inclination is to look for shortcuts. Okay, let's try to maybe get one of these electronic sharpeners that sharpens the knife quickly so don't have to bother. And yeah, it does okay, but it doesn't really get the knife sharp. And so thinking, okay, well, how do I really get a knife sharp? And then the only way to really get it sharp is to take your time with a sharpening stone, and you have a guide, and you work away at it. And sometimes if it hasn't been sharpened for a long time, or if the knife has gotten totally messed up on that electric sharpener that we've been using, then it takes a long time to reset the bevel of the edge. And so it takes time, you're working away at it, it seems like nothing's happening. It takes a long time. Okay, I've got the coarsest sharpening stone possible. Seems like nothing's happening. But you keep working away at it. And eventually the bevel gets set, and then you work up to finer sharpening stones. And then you have a knife that's really sharp. So it's really sharp, but it's not really, really sharp. Yeah. Sometimes you want the knife to be really, really sharp. So that takes another level of skill. So I started watching YouTube videos about sharpening samurai swords. And they don't use them for fighting nowadays, but collectors, they give them to this, there's like the top samurai sword sharpener in Japan. And when he sharpens a sword, it takes 10 days, 5 days of actual sharpening and 5 days of polishing, and 8 hours a day for 10 days. So about, 80 hours of work to get these things sharp, like properly sharp. And when a samurai sword is fully sharp, to its utmost level that this guy would be happy with, what you do is you take a thin silk scarf and toss it up in the air and let it slowly waft down over the upturned blade, and the scarf is just supposed to fall in half when it touches the blade. So I haven't got a knife that sharp yet. That's the hope. That's mastery. But that's the difference. So the difference between getting a knife really sharp and getting a knife so sharp that a silken scarf would fall in half when it falls on it, that's the difference between being good at something and being a master of something. And it seems like a small difference, but I think with the meditation, that's like the difference between the mind goes quiet sometimes and one is living one's life with samadhi always in the background, and the cultivation is really starting to take root. Of course, the ultimate mastery being a complete relinquishment, arhantship, the attainment of nibbana. So in that work, I mean, this guy who sharpens these samurai swords, 25 years of training to be able to do that. And he's considered a national treasure in Japan. This is one of the only guys who can get a sword that sharp. And yeah, it takes time. It takes a lot of thinking it over, contemplating, how do I do this? What's working? And also when we get discouraged, then coming back to that feeling that we initially had when we started to practice, that feeling of saddha, when did it first arise? And then to recall that feeling. Also, sometimes we get things wrong. We go off on a tangent, whether it's in the meditation or in life, in the monk's life, in the monastery, go off on a tangent, lose the plot, get distracted for a week, month, a year, years, and we have to backtrack. We don't just give up, but we can backtrack. So October 23rd to November 6th, very recently, I was on Tudong with Tanpa Muto, walking from Fort Bragg up into Avenue of the Giants and then back to Ubayagiri following Highway 101. Day 12, I think it was, Garberville, met up with this older Native American guy who him and his wife ended up offering us a meal that day. And we had really hit it off with them, made friends, started talking for a long time, spent the entire day with them. He also walked with us for a period of time that day. And while we were walking, he was a really interesting guy, and he had lots of stories of things he had done in his life, which I won't go into here. If you want to hear those stories, you can check the website. It's an hour and a half talk telling what he told us. But one thing he mentioned, which is worthy of note here, is for a period of his life, several years, he was living up in eastern Canada, in a very, very cold area by a place called Labrador, but living in the wilderness by himself. And it was a practice he was taking on to learn the old ways of hunting and gathering, followed by his ancestors. And so he was living as a hermit in this very, very remote, cold area. And this is many years ago now, when he was younger, but he was living off of collecting plants and hunting. And also there was a wolf that lived in this area. And he kind of, because he's by himself, he's became very aware of all the wildlife around him. So he decided one day, there was a hill nearby, and he noticed the wolf was kind of near that hill, and he wanted to track this wolf to see where it lived. And so it had just snowed, the wolf was nearby, he started following its prints. And its prints went up this hill, and as he was going up the hill, there was some prints that kind of went off to the side, but they were all leading up this hill, so they were all going in the direction of up this hill, so it seemed like the wolf had kind of come from different directions from time to time, but he was following the freshest set of prints and going up this hill, and they all led into this one wolf track going up this hill. So he got near the top, and there was a cave, and the prints kind of went into the cave, but then right at the front of the cave, they just stopped. And he thought, that's strange. I always thought I would either see this wolf here, or it seems like it lives here, but the prints just stop. There's no sign of him changing direction or going into the cave further. Fresh snow, prints just stop all of a sudden. And so he's thinking, that's really strange. But then he realized that wolves know how to backtrack. So this wolf, what it had done was it had walked backwards. It had gone, it knew it was being followed, had gone up to the cave, and then walked backwards in its own prints without creating new prints, and then had gone off on one of these side tracks, still walking backwards. So he turned around and he went, and then the wolf was there behind him on one of these side tracks. And so he thought it's a lovely story because knowing how to backtrack is an important skill. And so we, in the practice, in the meditation, where did we go off? Where did we lose the plot? And then we can backtrack, trace our way back to where was it? What happened? And then we get back to that point. Oh, we can go in the right direction. That's probably where this Native American saying comes from. No matter how far you've gone in the wrong direction, when you realize it, turn back. So sometimes there's the desire just to keep going, just by virtue that we've gone so far that way, we might as well just keep going, even though we know it's the wrong direction. Just we can't turn back because we've just gone so far. But no matter how far you've gone in the wrong direction, when you realize it, then turn back. And we can do that. We can turn back. We can get back to the right direction. Another aspect of practice is what I like to think of as cultivating true principle. So as, say, card-carrying Buddhists, you know, I follow the five precepts, I'm a Buddhist, I might be vegetarian. So, but sometimes we can get into this mode of in the practice, or we aren't really content or really happy in life in general. Why is that? So a couple things is true principle entails an internalization of the precepts. And there's principles behind the precepts, principles of non-harming, of simplicity. Also, the mindfulness is pointing to a principle which is deep inside of us, and that's the principle of being truly alive. And that's when the Buddha said, those who have mindfulness are truly alive, and those who have no mindfulness are as if dead already. That's that being truly alive, and then really living life with mindfulness. And so I've met people like this where they're not, you know, Buddhist or even following precepts, but they're living a very good life. They're very alive and happy also. And if you look at their life, those true principles are internalized for them. They have Dhamma in the heart, whether they know it or not. And so this is like a this guy who we stayed with on the last night of our tudong, who we know he's a few years older than me, Heath Garman. He's been working at the monastery since we opened. Drives heavy machinery. He has a wonderful family, wife, two daughters. We got to stay at his place. It's halfway between Willits and Laytonville. The last night of our tudong, he saw us in his big truck. He's honking at us and on the highway, and then his wife invited us into their house. We stayed there. And also, just a little bit about just Heath. It's just this whole family, the Garmans, they're salt of the earth people. They're really good people. I feel like I've can learn a lot from them in the way that they live. I remember being at the monastery and driving up the hill with Heath one day, and somehow we got talking about someone who had committed suicide recently, and Heath was saying, how could someone commit suicide? Life is just so awesome. And I said, yeah, for someone with you, you have blessings. You have a good family. And life is awesome, but not everyone is in that situation. But yeah, if you have mindfulness and true principle, life is awesome. It's not, doesn't feel mediocre or just kind of ho-hum, a life, big deal, gonna die. Or like somebody told me, it's like, life sucks and then you die. That's the first noble truth. But no, it's... So we're shifting out of that attitude a bit. But we were staying at his house, and they're Heath and his brother. They live nearby each other. They both have families. His brother came by, and it was the evening time. We're just hanging out, chatting in his house by the fire, and they're big guys, and like they drive trucks, and they operate heavy machinery, and they love their work, but they were out down on their knees offering us things with devotion, and it was it wasn't forced at all. So with true principle, these things are internalized. They're not at all forced, but it's a natural way of operating out of that space of contentment, mindfulness, well-being. And Heath was kind of telling us he doesn't sleep very much because he works all day, and then he goes home and he has these projects he does, but he doesn't feel tired, he doesn't feel worn out, he doesn't feel burdened by it. So it's like taking life on in a way where we're not afraid to live life. And we have the precepts, we have the training, but it doesn't have to be a burden. It's for the sake of lifting the burdens of not being mindful, lifting the burden of not having precepts. This is for the sake of being unburdened, not for the sake of being burdened. For the sake of being unfettered, not for the sake of being fettered. Another guy, our water maintenance guy, well, plumbing guy. He has been coming to the monastery for 17 years. And again, this guy is someone who, he's not quote-unquote Buddhist, but there's true principle there. He's coming to the monastery for 17 years, from very early on, not charging us for his labor, but just for parts. So done hundreds and hundreds of hours of work, in the monastery, just for our extensive water system and coming over the years. I've worked with him over the years, and he's just a rough and tumble guy from Willits, but there's that principle is there in the heart, that principle of generosity. And I asked him once years ago, why are you offering your labor like this? What compelled you to do that? And he said, well, it just seems like a noble thing to do. And he actually used the word noble. And still to this day, he's just recently offered a huge amount of time for quite an extensive upgrade to our water system. And then now he brings food as well. And so it's even, he has a garden, he brings food. And I said, Dave, why don't you stay for the meal? He said, I just feel like I just want to give. I don't want to take it all from you guys. I just want to give. So there it is again, this true principle. So it's like internalizing these things. We don't have to worry about the direction we're moving in as long as we internalize these things. That's the Opanaiko Dhamma, and one of the qualities of Dhamma. Opanaiko, which in the chanting book is translated as leading inwards. Sometimes it's translated as leading onwards, but a few years back when Bhikkhu Bodhi was visiting Abhayagiri, he was telling us that neither of those translations is what Opanaiko really means. And Opanaiko actually means to be internalized, but what are we to do? We can't chant it to be internalized. He said it's a gerund, which means to be internalized or to be brought into the heart. The Dhamma is to be brought in, not just to be chanted or read about, or to be brought in. So Opanaiko, it's to be internalized. Pachatang vedita bo vanyuhi. It's to be realized for each wise person for themselves. Akaliko, timeless. It's apparent here and now. The teaching is very interesting because it's just like talking about learning a skill or moving towards mastering something. It's not apparent at first, the meaning of some of these things. Like when you read the suttas, like the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, there's things we'll miss, there's things that aren't apparent. But somebody asking the Buddha, what does it mean that the Dhamma is apparent here and now? And the Buddha just answers by saying, when one has a thought of anger and one knows a thought of anger has arisen, that's how the Dhamma is apparent here and now. So it's not like this etheric energy that's apparent here and now. It's truth. It's the truth of the way things are. It's the way it is. It's apparent here and now. Or like when we talk about like the Bharami of the Kruba Ajahns or the Bharami of the Buddha, it's not some sort of like energy field that is somehow over us. It's more, this is what we receive. It's very direct. It's what we receive from them. So if we take like the Bharami of Lungpa Cha as an example, so the way he lived his life, he practiced very, very hard. He tried all sorts of modes of contemplation, and he didn't have it as easy as us. He couldn't just put in an MP3 player with 1,000 Dhamma talks on it and listen to them. And in the past, and they didn't have internet either, they had to actually, when he wanted to go find Ajahn Mun and receive teachings, he had to walk and seek him out and ask people and track him down. And it could take years. people had to track down Ajahn Mun. Yet that's good. That's priming the mind. That energy is. So the way Lungpor Cha practiced, this is his barami we're talking about. The way he practiced, you know, he tried all these different things. The Buddha as well tried all sorts of different ways of practice. And when Lungpor Cha was a junior monk and practicing, the translations, there wasn't really translations of the teachings. The Vinaya, the way the Vinaya was practiced, it wasn't clear. It wasn't a well-established tradition like we have now. But he was very, very committed and sincere. It's as if he was learning sharpening, but didn't have a sharpening stone. He just had to find things that would make his knife sharp. He found the stones that worked. He couldn't just go on Amazon and buy a 4,000, 8,000 grit Japanese water stone for $89.95. He had to find what worked. He had to find what worked for him. And he had to seek out Lungpor Mun just like everybody else. He had to track him down. And then, as Lungpor Cha practiced, and he started breaking through to the Dhamma, and eventually founding Wat Nong Papong, and really putting incredible effort, unbelievable effort into teaching and training and leading this community. And in the early days of Wat Nong Papong, there was malaria. It was very, very austere. I mean, we should be, actually, even now, Wat Papong is a very good training monastery. We should be glad that this isn't a Wat Papong monastic retreat, because if it was, the wake-up bell would ring at 2:45 a.m. and we'd be in here for morning chanting at 3:15. Although they do have evening puja a bit earlier, it's at 6:15. It's not at 7. It's 45 minutes earlier. But Lungpor Cha, I mean, he put so much effort into, and there's like a sense of looking out for his community, going out of his way to look out for people. And it's just immense compassion. And he had, from very early on, the monks' community and the nuns' community, the Meiji, the white robe nuns, very, very strong monks and nuns' communities there, Wat Nong Papong, to this day. But he established that and really put effort into putting that into place. And then over the years, there's stories. Some people may have read Venerable Father Ajahn Pasano being a direct disciple of Lungpor Cha. So we hear stories, and it wasn't a walk in the park. It wasn't easy living with Lungpor Cha. So he trained people. He could read, kind of like the Buddha, being able to tailor the teaching and read where people were at. And I've heard that even for some of the Thai disciples of Lungpor Cha, who had complete unquestioning faith in him, even they would be rattled by the way they were treated by Lungpor Cha sometimes. And so he was... But that's amazing. That's amazing that he would do that, because now, without that kind of effort that he put into training the community at Wat Nong Papong, and then through his subsequent illness, 14 years of being looked after by his disciples, by the community, what we have now is the Barami of Lungpur Cha. So any book we've read from Lungpur Cha, any time we go to a Wat Pa Pong branch monastery, this comes from the Barami of Lungpur Cha, the Barami of the Krupa Ajahn's, and then coming directly from the Barami of the Buddha as the root. So these things, we're heirs to this. These things are passed down to us. I've heard also that Lungpur Cha was someone who was truly alive. One of the epithets for an arhant is one who is always mindful. And, Lungpur Cha, truly alive. And he was enjoying himself. I mean, you see this with Lungpur Liam as well. If one draws close to Lungpur Liam, he is very aloof unless you draw close to him. So that's the opportunity to be his attendant for a period of time. If one is his attendant, then one draws close and really get a sense of this. It's like a perpetual delighting in relinquishment. Just, and the more off the wall it is, like if somebody comes to Lungpur Liam with some problem, it's like the more off the wall it is, the more delight he has, it seems, because he's just letting go of it. It's not his problem. So it's like the bigger the problem, the more the delight, because I'm not picking it up. That was the most striking thing about Lungpur Liam, I think. It's like, you know, this monk said he's going to kill someone. It's like, okay, I'm not picking it up. Or, Lungpur, I'm not touching it with a 10-foot pole. It's... You just see it. He has a huge smile. Somebody comes to him, they're very distressed. There's a big problem. Like, this monk, you won't believe what he did. They think, okay, they're going to get Lungpur Liam on their side. And he's just like, so? What's the big deal? Yeah, it's like taking a delight in the training, taking a delight in relinquishment. It's for the sake of being unburdened, not for the sake of being burdened. It's for the sake of being unfettered. It's the sake of being cool and clear, not for being muddled and hot and confused. It's for the sake of joy. It's for the sake of happiness, not for the sake of sadness, dejection. Although if we've gone down a wrong path, then we will have sadness and dejection. We have to backtrack. Where did we go off? Where did that start? So we backtrack. Okay, that's what happened. That's where we went off. And then we keep moving in the right direction. So I wish everyone all the best on the next day and a half. And may you all learn to live life fully according to true principle and be freed from any sadness, from any grief you may be experiencing. And I'll leave it there.